Yeah. And, you know, in the early years too, just like convincing people that this was even a thing that had a place in their life. Like up until like 2015, 2016, really, it was our competition was not other apps. Our competition was paper. And it was really convincing people that were already out in the backcountry using maps that like, here's an alternative, and that this is a thing that, believe it or not, this really actually works. Like, you know, one of the main criticisms we would get from people was, yeah, but there's not cell phone service everywhere, so this is garbage. They're like, no, you can download the maps for offline, and your phone has a GPS chip in it, and it works in the middle of the wilderness. And those early years, that was kind of one of the big challenges, was convincing people that this was a thing that would be useful in their life.
All Aspects is brought to you by Aspect Avi. Aspect Avi is a new safety tool that helps you make safer decisions in the backcountry. Did you know that we currently, as an industry, spend $1 billion per year on reactive avalanche gear? So that's your beacon, shovel probe, airbag. All those things only help you after you've been avalanche. Aspect Avi is the first preventative avalanche safety tool that is designed to keep you out of avalanches altogether. Our algorithm processes a huge amount of data and scrapes the avalanche forecast in every forecast zone across the country. Then it shows you on the map where it's high and low risk for today's avalanche danger. Clear means low risk. Red is high risk. Red equals dead. Don't go in there. This is called adaptive slope shading, or ASS. The reason why this is so revolutionary is because it changes and updates as the conditions change. Nobody else has ASS because we invented it. Aspect Avi also has a ton of awesome tools built into it, like a tri-axis slope angle meter, trailhead and drop-in checklist, and my personal favorite, the forecast update tool. The best part is Aspect Avi is giving away this life-saving tool 100% free. Aspect Avi is committed to making the backcountry safer and more fun for everyone in our community. You can download Aspect Avi on iOS right now for the App Store. Android, it's coming soon. Remember, there are dozens of apps that get you into the backcountry, but only Aspect Avi is designed to bring you home safely. Thanks to our business daddy, Aspect Avi, for making the All Aspects podcast possible. Now let's get to the show.
Hey, welcome back to the All Aspects podcast. We're really excited to welcome Jesse Crocker today. He's one of the co-founders of Gaia GPS, one of your favorite mapping apps. But before that, he was also a pro ski patroller at Kirkwood and Big Sky. And he's also done some wild adventures like kite ski across Greenland, which kind of melts my brain. So we always do each week, we talk about how to do inherently dangerous things, whether it's doing a startup company or traveling across Greenland, the safest way possible. So Jesse, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Oh yeah, man. Excited to talk to you. Let's just jump right into this, man. So when I was looking up your backstory a little bit, you're a Bay Area kid, right?
Yep.
Okay. So were you always kind of interested in like computers and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I grew up kind of around the tech industry. One of my dad's good friends was a computer programmer who kind of introduced me at a very young age to like that was a career path. And my dad painted houses, and computer programming seemed a lot more appealing than painting houses.
That's fair. And then when I was looking kind of your backstory up, it said your first like gig doing computer, I guess, what would you say, computer science stuff? Like you were tracking bison?
Yeah, so I worked for a nonprofit in West Yellowstone, Montana, that is trying to get more habitat for bison outside of Yellowstone National Park. So they have volunteers out in the field all winter long on skis and snowshoes, going and seeing where the bison are and what they're doing, and documenting sort of the different government management actions around the bison. And I spent a bunch of time actually in the field out with the bison in like minus 45 degree weather in West Yellowstone in the winter. But then also a lot of time working on the computer side of things, working on building a computer system for all these volunteers who are out in the field to log all their observations. So people come back at the end of the day and record, we saw this many bison doing this. We saw seven elk. We saw a porcupine. And creating a whole system for that, and that now has 20 years of observations from tens of thousands of volunteer days in the field. And that was kind of my introduction to working on the mapping side of computers.
Dang. Okay. Does that still exist? Does that system still, are they still using it?
It got replaced last year, finally, after being in use for 15, 18 years, something like that. But the data is all in use. There's actually someone's doing a PhD thesis with all that data right now.
That's awesome. Hell yeah. Was that how, so was like freezing your ass off chasing bison around how you kind of got into the backcountry scene?
Yeah, that was, before that I had spent, you know, all growing up I snowboarded and I moved to West Yellowstone. And the first time I threw snowshoes on and a snowboard on my backpack, I saw the potential for having a lot of fun, and honestly, I couldn't afford lift tickets, but snowshoeing was not the thing. I, like, after a month of that, went out and bought the cheapest touring skis I could buy and didn't step on a snowboard again for a long time.
That makes sense. So then we're just kind of skating through the backstory here. You then went from that to joining Ski Patrol at Big Sky first, or Kirkwood?
Yeah, I spent a year as a volunteer at Big Sky, kind of doing the ski bum thing, working on the volunteer patrol and skiing as many days as I possibly could.
While you were doing that stuff, you were still playing around, like playing around in the background with building kind of mapping apps, or like what were you doing in your free time at this time in your life?
Yeah, so after Big Sky, I went to Kirkwood, California, and was on Pro Patrol there for 4 years. And kind of 3 years into it, realized my knees were not going to take 30 years of patrolling. looking at guys I worked with, and realized that I had to come up with another line of work. And it was right as iPhone was coming on the scene. So decided I better get back into computer programming, because that would let me still go out and play and have fun and not just be wrecked on my days off work. So I built a couple apps during my last year of Ski Patrol. Built an app for looking at snowtail data, and then I built an app called Avalanche Lab that was for recording snow pit data and recording avalanche occurrences. Really kind of aimed at the pro side of things, like looking at data logging we're doing at work, and like, how can we make this easier? How can I not have to carry a field book for all of the compliance that needs to get done in a professional avalanche operating environment?
So okay, so you said you got back into this when the iPhone was coming out. So what was that, like 2003? Like when was that?
What? No. It was, what would that have been, like 2009?
Okay,
yeah, 2010, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, 2010, 2009 was kind of the first year we could build apps on the iPhone. It was like iOS 3 came out, and then we could build real apps for it. And okay. I got immediately got on it. Like seemed like there was huge potential there.
Yeah, that's smart. that paid off.
So yeah, then I was still doing Ski Patrol and doing that, and then actually, that year I went to National Avalanche School, and the field session of National Avalanche School, I got to have Bruce Tremper as my instructor for the field session. And Bruce was like, the first day he was like, okay, like this new thing came out and we're doing maps on phones now, and this is going to be the future, and everyone needs to get this app for mapping on their phone. And that app was Gaia GPS. And it was like months after, just a few months after the first version of Gaia GPS came out. And it was maps and track recording. It didn't do anywhere near the amount that any of the mapping apps these days do. And that year, finished out my season of ski patrolling, and then concluded that I had to be done patrolling at the end of that year, that like iPhone development was definitely where it was happening. I was getting lots of great feedback about my Avalanche app, Avalanche Lab, but like not making any money off it. And realized that I should think about working on something else. And then saw a job ad online for Gaia GPS and responded to that. And the couple that originally founded Gaia GPS, Andrew and Anna, looked me up online, or I think Anna searched her email for my name and found it in two places. One was from the Pacific Crest Trail mailing list, talking about a winter trip I had done on the John Muir Trail. And then one was on an email list about the mapping library that I used in Avalanche Lab and that Gaia GPS used. And like the intersection of those two things was like, okay, great, you're hired.
Nice.
So I started working at Gaia GPS like kind of immediately. And then at ISSW that year, I saw my patrol director and was like, okay, I'm done. And then about a year into Gaia GPS, I guess Andrew and Anna saw the potential in me that I don't know that I saw in myself at the time, but like they saw how much knowledge I had about the mapping side of things and gave me the title of being a co-founder of Gaia GPS and gave me an equal share of the company that they each had.
Wow.
And I ran the kind of the whole mapping side of things at Gaia GPS. So led her intro into making our own maps instead of just using maps licensed from other people, built the Android app, led the web team for some years, led the iOS team for some years, and then eventually led kind of the whole software engineering side of things.
Damn. That's awesome. Wait, really, really quick. Can I ask one question? What did the Avalanche Lab app do?
So it was recording snow pit data, logging pit data, logging weather observations, and then mapping out slides. So the, you know, kind of the standard book that's used for in the U.S. for recording all that stuff is this thing called SWAG, the Snow Weather Avalanche Guidelines. And tons of people, avalanche professionals, are out there every day taking very exact notes based on this very specific data that needs to be collected. And it was basically a way to automate doing that and being able to submit it and document it easily.
Wait, so how are you aggregating all that data back then?
So you could input it into the phone and then generate a diagram of a snow pit, just like you draw in a field book. And generate a text format of your weather observations just like you'd enter in a field book, and then be able to email that off or print it out. So you print it out and put it in your field book.
Okay.
And then about 6 months into Gaia GPS, like I realized that one of the two things I was working on was going to make money, and one of them wasn't. And I sold off Avalanche Lab to someone.
Okay. So when you sold Avalanche, like you sold it to a totally different group than Gaia.
Yeah, I sold it to a guy who lives in Colorado who unfortunately has never really done anything with it. It's kind of a shame. There was some good potential there, but I think he ran into this shortly, saw the same thing I did, that it was going to be a very hard market to actually make money in, especially targeting the professional side of things. Like,
yeah,
the number of avalanche professionals in the U.S. is small, and you're trying to convince them to replace a paper notebook that their job is probably paying for anyway with something they have to pay for themselves. So the price we could reasonably charge was low, and it was just never going to be enough to pay the bills.
That's super cool, and like really very forward thinking for the time. I mean, it's hard to imagine now because mapping is such a thing. You know, there's, I don't know, you probably know, there's probably 100+ mapping apps in the app store. But back then when you were doing Gaia, maybe we could talk a little bit about sort of the technical challenges of getting Gaia going, and also the sort of social challenges of getting buy-in back then, like Garmin was a box that you set on your dashboard. Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the people, especially in the snow and avalanche world, were super nervous at that point. Like, I think 2011, maybe, like I went up to the CAA, Canadian Avalanche Association annual group meeting, and gave a talk. And I straight up had people telling me that I was going to get people killed by encouraging them to carry phones in the backcountry. Yeah. They're like, no, if people have a phone in their backpack, their beacon isn't going to work, and you're going to get people killed. And it was like, you know, like there are some issues there, but anecdotally, we've done a bunch of testing, and this is pretty this is not nearly as much of an issue. And they're like, well, the batteries are going to die and you're going to get people killed. Like, you know, no, we're actually making it a lot easier for folks with less experience to keep themselves safe here.
Well, yeah.
As an analog,
Jeff knows all about that.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot too, where people say, you know, Jeff, the real problem is that people don't know how to navigate with a map, compass, and altimeter. And that's what we need to be focusing on, is training the millions of people out in avalanche train every year. If they only knew how to do that, we'd be all right. And I'm just like, whoa. Like, when I'm examining guides, they can barely do it old school analog style, let alone the general public. It takes, I mean, hundreds of hours of practice and mentorship. It's just, it's so much harder. And then that cognitive load, it's all you can do to navigate in a whiteout using paper map and compass and altimeter. And then you've got no more energy left over to manage your group through the terrain and deal with the avalanche problem.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of resistance, like I would say up until like 6 or 7 years ago, to just the idea that it was okay for people to take smartphones in the backcountry.
Which everyone is doing anyway, like the normies.
I think it's like if you asked, like I was a geographer and did map making in college and cartography and GIS. And I think it'd be like talking to a cartographer, you know, 15, 20 years ago and said, hey, you know, people are going to follow a blue dot around when they're driving through Denver or San Francisco or wherever. And they would have been like, that's crazy. That's going to kill people. That's, you're going to get it wrong. Rah, 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 rah. And you're like, it's so much harder with a paper map to drive and navigate. The cognitive load is so much higher. And like, certainly on a glacier, when I pull out a paper map, I'm like, oh, I forgot to laminate this one. And now it's a full storm and it's falling apart. One time I had my laminated map blow away because it was such a heinous storm. And I'm like, oh, God, now we're totally hosed.
Wait, Jesse, I want to. So, well, actually kind of piggybacking on that, I'm assuming you all had to develop a good amount of the tech that kind of became the base layer for mapping apps as we know it, right?
I think in the first couple years of Gaia GPS, a lot of it was really even trying to figure out like what should these products actually do? Like we know what a Garmin handheld GPS does and we know what a paper map does. And a smartphone has all these capabilities, but like what features do you actually want in a GPS app? Just trying to figure that out was a big one in the early years. There was lots of interesting technical problems too, like mostly related to just the amount of data people had as time went by. You know, people who are out every day recording GPS tracks and all of a sudden they have 10,000 miles of tracks and figuring out how to deal with those. But I would say, honestly, the harder part was really just figuring out the features and what the useful things were.
Do you remember specifically any one kind of feature or capability that really surprised you that people really wanted that you guys didn't see?
So one of the features we worked on kind of in the early years was layered maps. So the ability to combine multiple map layers and put them together and control the opacity and kind of build your own map. And that really surprised us, kind of how popular it was and also how many map layers people would use. You know, we'd get screenshots from people, tech support emails. They were like, I was using 15 different map layers all stacked on top of each other and the map didn't work so well.
And you're like,
I test with like two or three, like, what are you doing with 15?
Wow. Yeah. I'm curious.
Why isn't it working? Well, I guess it's good to stress test it in that way, you know?
Yeah.
Then you know.
So Jesse, it sounds like one of the challenges was envisioning what the future user experience would be like, of what people would need they hadn't quite imagined yet. Is that accurate?
Yeah. And, you know, in the early years too, just like convincing people that this was even a thing that had a place in their life. Like up until like 2015, 2016, really, it was, our competition was not other apps. Our competition was paper. And it was really convincing people that were already out in the backcountry using maps that, like, here's an alternative. And that this is a thing that, believe it or not, this really actually works. Like, you know, one of the main criticisms we would get from people was, yeah, but there's not cell phone service everywhere, so this is garbage. And you're like, no, you can download the maps for offline, and your phone has a GPS chip in it, and it works in the middle of the wilderness. And those early years, that was kind of one of the big challenges, was convincing people that this was a thing that would be useful in their life. And then at some point, I think it moved just from the target market being those people to all of a sudden we were not just making things easier for existing backcountry travelers, but enabling people who previously didn't feel comfortable going in the backcountry, and not just on snow, but hiking, biking, people who didn't feel that they could safely do that because they didn't know how to read a map and compass. Like, I've had so many people tell me that, like, Gaia GPS changed my life because previously I couldn't go hiking by myself. I could only go hiking with my friend that knew how to read a map, or I could only go hiking with my husband, and now I can go out by myself. And, like, those are the stories I love hearing about, like, this thing enabled me to go out and comfortably go out in the backcountry by myself or with my other friends who also weren't comfortable with maps and compasses.
That's awesome.
And in some ways, hearing that is a little scary too, because, like, I still carry a paper map and compass sometimes, though these days more often it's a phone and a hardware GPS, but people still need to have backup. Like, phones are fallible. They don't always work. Batteries die. They get dropped in rivers.
I like telling my team, like, if we're going to go ski the oat route or something like that, I'll send them. I'll be like, hey, download this on Gaia, get the app, and here is my tracks from the last couple years. So we all have that, and they're super psyched because then they get to preview the route and get all geeky about it and get excited, and they get to kind of pre-live the experience beforehand. And then we've got five phones with all the tracks loaded up. And if one phone dies, I'm like, next phone, pass it forward. Next phone dies, pass it forward. We're super redundant in that way.
Yeah.
So, like, you said, like, paper was your competition. What was there, like, a point where a bunch of other mapping apps started popping up and you guys had kind of real technical competition, or what did that look like? Because obviously other mapping apps started.
Yeah, so I don't even remember what year that was, but yeah, at some point there started to be more competition. A lot of our competition in the early years kind of is apps that don't exist anymore. I think there was a lot of people who thought they were going to build an app and ship it, and then they were going to be done with it. And it was going to be a thing that was going to make them money, but they weren't going to have to continuously work on. Whereas, like, with Gaia GPS, you know, for a long time, we were kind of steady at about five people working on it. But we had a team of five people working on that almost all the time, constantly improving things. And that, you know, let us kind of stay ahead of the competition for a long time. And, you know, kind of different niches too, though. Like, in the original idea with Gaia GPS was hiking and backpacking. But very quickly, I think we realized that we couldn't just focus on those sports because there wasn't a big enough market just for that at that time. You know, the way I think about it now, like, at that time, maybe 5% of the people who were interested in hiking and backpacking would be willing to use an app. And that was not big enough. So we had to look at other sports. And some of those kind of took us by surprise. Like, you know, 6 or 8 years ago, overlanding started to get really big. And we kind of got dragged kicking and screaming into overlanding. Like, it was not something that we necessarily knew about, but all of a sudden people were sending in questions about, like, you know, I'm going to drive this 500 mile route through dirt roads of Utah BLM, and your app needs this one feature to make it happen. And we were like, what is this? Who are these people? And we kind of, there were a bunch of markets we got dragged into that way, but we really, yeah, focused on a lot of markets in those early years.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Gaia was free for the first, like, what, 6 or 8 years that it existed?
No. So originally the app, I think we launched it like $1.99 a year, and then eventually got, or not $1.99 a year, $1.99 up front. That was kind of before the era of subscriptions. And then eventually we got to $20 up front plus $20 a year for a subscription. The subscription got you access to some additional map layers. Mm. But still, the subscription was a small percentage of users. Like, the majority of people, just the base app worked for what they needed. And then eventually we relaunched the app. So we launched it as a new app. Internally, we called it Gaia GPS Next Generation. And we launched a whole new app on the App Store that had a free tier that you could do some things, but to use it in the backcountry, you really needed a subscription that was, I think we started at $20 a year. And we were probably a couple of years too late doing that. We should have done it a little sooner. A lot of apps had already started to move to subscriptions, and that was what enabled us to really grow. Like, for years, we were able to have a staff of 5 or 6 people. And then after that, it was like every year, hire 2 or 3 more people and have them building cool stuff. And the company was able to support that.
Well, I feel like a lot of people don't know this. And the only reason I've really ever thought about this is because I'm now involved with Aspect Abbey. But it costs money to run a mapping app. Like, even if everyone on your team is a developer or whatever, like, the data, like, just to create the mapping layers and do all that stuff, like, costs money and to, like, upkeep it. So did that, can you just tell me a little bit, like, how the cost of that changed and how, like, the kind of business of that changed in the time that Gaia was happening?
Yeah, that was a big part of relaunching Gaia GPS as a subscription app, was that there were users that had paid $1.99 5 years ago that the cost of those users at that point, like, how much we had spent serving them maps, was like many times what they had paid. Maps are expensive. Satellite imagery, like, costs a whole lot of money to make and costs a lot of money to buy. Maps are big. Syncing photos are big. All of this stuff costs money. It's really easy to lose money on a mapping application. I think definitely our competitors in those years ended up going out of business because they didn't understand how much it was going to cost and their products were too cheap. And after a year, they realized that they were losing money on every single customer and had to go out of business.
Yeah. And at that point you're screwed because you're like, well, we can't just now go from charging like $1 a year to charging $100 a year. Like, that's going to kill us too.
Yep.
Hey everyone, hope you're enjoying the pod so far. I just wanted to take a quick break to tell you about one of the most unique features of Aspect Abbey, which is the forecast update tool. The forecast update tool allows you to input real-time feedback about snow conditions and stability into the app as you're touring. So say we're out touring in this area, it's a moderate day, but all of a sudden we experience signs of instability. We come up to the corner and we click this little button right here, brings up the forecast update tool. Then we can go in and let's say we got whoops and we got shooting cracks. We click done. Your map is going to be updated to considerable Abbey danger and will now have the updated high and low risk areas painted onto the map in that forecast zone. This works even offline, which is super badass. If you want to try out the forecast update tool for yourself, head on over to the App Store and download Aspect Abbey for free on iOS. Okay, back to the show.
Jesse, can I ask you a bit about risk in a startup?
Yeah.
Are there some parallels with managing risk with leading a dev team, a development team, whether it was the Android or iOS version or web app and stuff, with Gaia, and being like, okay, we're going to do something where the outcome is uncertain. No one's done this before. And say being on a control route with explosives going hunting for avalanches when you're back at Kirkwood. Are there's some similarities of how the team manages risk and how you manage your team into the unknown?
Ooh, that's interesting. You know, being inside working at a computer, the risks are different. There's financial risk, there's reputational risk, especially like leading a team of software engineers. There's risk of kind of your reputation with the outside world, your reputation with your team, keeping the respect of your team. But it's, you know, I feel like in the ski patrol world, that risk leads to team bonding. Like, you know, the feeling on ski patrol is like what, you know, I think it's hear people describe the military as like a band of brothers, and these guys are in your platoon are the closest people in your life, closer than your family. And I think ski patrol, the risk leads to that same sort of bonding. And in the software world, I don't think that happens. Like, you know, the software world, we buy people t-shirts and hats and try and create team bonding. Yeah, try and create team bonding that way. You give people a sticker for their water bottle, but
it's the explosives. The explosives is what brings people together.
Yeah, but there certainly is a ton of risk on just the financial side of things. Like, I have spent months and months working on things with no idea if they were going to work out. Like, so my current project, I think, depending on how you want to look at it, is maybe startup number 5 for me.
Oh, wow.
So we sold Gaia GPS in 2021. And after that, I started working on something totally different. My wife is a farmer, and I started working on software for greenhouse automation.
Oh, wow.
And cool. I spent probably 6 months building out a software platform for automating climate controls in greenhouses, and specifically targeting small farmers, and got to the point I had a great prototype, but then got to the point where I realized to actually take it to market, I was going to have to hire people and like hire probably like 3 people, who some mechanical engineers, maybe another software engineer. And I didn't have the appetite for the risk. Like that was purely financial risk. Like I was either going to have to put up a lot of money out of my pocket or give away most of my company to venture capitalists, and couldn't convince myself that it was a risk that had a high enough potential of paying off. So I ended up just shutting that down, like calling it a learning experience, learned some interesting software, had fun playing with hardware that I hadn't really interacted with before. But yeah, shut it down, like couldn't do it. And honestly, I think if I'd had the appetite for the risk, I think there's a decent chance it would have worked out.
Well, that's a great segue into your current project, which is Goat Maps, which is a new mapping app. I believe it just launched. Is that right?
Yeah. So after Gaia GPS, worked on the greenhouse thing, and then worked on a company doing weather forecasting for a while. And then, let's see, 2 summers ago, decided my son was kind of at the age where he could start really doing some backpacking. And we spent a month backpacking in the summer in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, and decided for most of that summer to just use paper maps.
Cool.
And because the idea of doing something with mapping again was already kicking around in my head. And I thought it would be fun to teach my son how to navigate with paper maps, but also would be a great time to think about like, okay, what are, you know, all of these mapping apps that are on the market now kind of look the same. Like what are the actual core features? What matters? So did a bunch of two different week-long trips and then a bunch of 3 or 4 day trips, all with paper maps, to really try to remember, like, what are the hard parts here?
What are the hard parts? Wait, like, going back, what did you learn? What was something that stood out to you?
I think my conclusion was that a lot of the hard parts were around when things went south, like metaphorically, not physically. you know, we had one trip where we started out with an objective of a route that we were going to do, and the second day came to a trail that just didn't exist. Oh. And came up with a new plan, and another day later, there's another trail that hadn't been maintained in 30 or 40 years, and tons of just replanning routes on the fly. Lots of needing to replan out in the field and like drastically different plans, you know, week-long trip where we're coming up with a lot of miles. This isn't like we're going to go 3 miles this way instead of 2 miles that way. It's like we're going to hop over the Continental Divide and go in a totally different watershed for 40 miles. And hopefully this other pass to get us back to the valley we live in actually goes.
Dang.
So then at the end of that summer, I was talking with Anna Johnson, who was one of the other co-founders of Gaia GPS, and just talking about what we were thinking about, what we were doing, and realized we had both been thinking about maybe building a new navigation app and not really sure what it was going to do at that point, but it sounded interesting. So February of this year kind of really started working on that and spent a few months kind of building lots of kind of off the wall features that maybe weren't going to go anywhere, but over the course of the summer coalesced into what we actually wanted to build. Last week we launched Goat Maps, which is a navigation app initially targeting hiking, backpacking, and backcountry skiing. Kind of because I can't build anything that's not for backcountry skiing. That's half my year, more than half my year.
Nice.
Currently it runs on iPhone, iPad, and Mac. And yeah.
Nice.
Wow. That's congratulations. Awesome. And what would you say is the differentiator with Goat Maps from Gaia?
Yeah. So we really wanted to focus hard on reliability and ease of use. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of these mapping apps that have been on the market for 5 years, 10 years have acquired all these weird features. I kind of like to use the analogy of barnacles on a boat. Like, you know, you build up these things and they slow down your progress of what you can do. And with software, you get all these features and 1% of your users might use them. And you don't want to get rid of them because those 1% of users are helping pay the bills. So you end up with all these weird features that slow down your team, make the product more complicated, even though most people don't really need them. Mm. So Goat Maps was a great chance to just start over, really thinking about like, what are the features that actually matter? Like on that backpack, those backpacking trips I was talking about, we were really thinking about like, what are the features we actually need to make this work? And it came down to offline maps that are totally solid, that you don't have to worry about whether they're going to work or not. Track recording and really good route planning tools. And really quickly being able to replan a route in the field and measure where you're going. So those are kind of the big areas we focused on for Goat Maps. Like, it does a lot less than any of our competition. Hmm. But I think it does everything that a lot of people are going to need. You know, we get a lot of people asking, like, for my search and rescue missions, I need this one feature. And it's like, you know, maybe that feature may not end up being something we're going to build because it takes a lot of time and it's going to make the app more complicated for recreational users. Like, it could be that for your week-long SAR mission, Cal Topo is going to be the best option because they're really focused on that market. But I'd like to think that for your 3-day ski tour or your week long backpacking trip or your 30-mile wilderness trail running loop, that Goat Maps is going to be the best option because we're focused hard on that.
Is there a, so I'm just reading your description here really quick. It says, introducing Goat Maps, the next generation of mapping for outdoor adventure, built from the ground up for speed and reliability. Maps, route planning, navigation, no BS. So like, I love that mission. It's just like it, from that description, you're like, okay, that sounds like the most basic mapping app ever. But then having you, you know, fill it in a little more is kind of cool. It's like, hey, we're going back to the basics of like, dude, I went and used a map, literally a paper map all summer. And these were the things that I actually needed. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And, you know, we are doing some new innovative things too. Like one of the features that we prototyped very early on and is going to launch in our next version is the ability to do totally custom slope angle shading. I also 2 years ago, like decided to start over on my avalanche education path. So went 2 years ago and did an Airy level 1 and last year did an Airy level 2. And some of that was definitely market research. Like I'm wondering what are these classes teaching people to do? And how can I build a product that's going to work for that? And a lot in that Airy level 1, they're talking about, you know, crossing off terrain at the beginning of the day as part of your trip plan, which is a lot what you guys are doing with Aspect Abbey too. So my take on that was, you know, kind of all these apps have this standard slope angle shading that people don't know how to, some people know how to read, but certainly people at the beginner level in those Airy courses do not know what to make of it.
Yeah. 10 colors is pretty overwhelming. It just
looks pretty.
Yeah, so, and you know, those, maybe the very beginners are not what I was focused on, but I wanted to build a tool for myself going out and planning a trip to really quickly be able to say like, okay, north facing terrain over 30 degrees above 6,000 feet is out of bounds for the day.
Yeah.
And so we built a feature in Goat Maps to, you know, in 30 seconds, I can color that terrain red and I can color, you know, let's say southwest to southeast facing slopes under 35 green. And use that to plan, to build my trip plan for the day.
Mm.
So we're doing innovative stuff in Goat Maps too. You know, it's not all things that people were doing 10 years ago. And I'd like to think we're doing a lot of innovating things with trip planning too. One of the other features I really wanted was the ability to plan out trips where I'm doing point to point sections and snap to trail and just freehand drawing lines all together. Because especially planning ski tours, like we're not on trails. So yeah. The whole snap to trail thing doesn't work. But we're also, you know, not just taking straight lines all the time. You know, you might be planning an uptrack on something where you know you're gonna do 5 huge switchbacks. And I really wanted to be able to like measure out like, okay, what's the actual distance we're going to cover there on those kind of routes? What's the actual grade we're going to do? So we did a lot of work on being able to combine those in the route planner and get good info from the route planner.
Will you be able to do that offline?
Yeah. So currently we don't have snap to trail while you're offline, but we're working on that. And we're even working on some other things with that too, like being able to snap to rivers also. Like, you know, one of my summer sports is pack rafting. And for pack rafting, I really want to be able to snap to rivers when planning out those multi-sport routes.
Really, really quickly, can you, just for myself and for listeners, watchers, can you explain snap to?
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of what you're used to with Google Maps or Apple Maps. You enter in a start and an end location and it puts you on a road. So that's kind of the simplest form of it, is you give it 2 points and it gives you a road or a trail, whichever you've requested. But then also with Goat Maps, we have a feature where instead of just tapping 2 points on the map or entering names of points, you can draw with your finger kind of near a trail and then tell it, put me on the trail. And it will snap your route exactly onto that trail, which is great for coming up with more accurate mileage estimations and more accurate elevation gain estimations. So you can very roughly draw along a series of trails, and then it'll put you exactly on that trail.
Wow, that's cool. Okay, rad. Thanks. That's cool. I think, I look forward to playing around with this more. That's awesome. Can I ask you, totally change topics and ask you one other question about your life? You kite skied across Greenland, dude. What's that about?
Yeah, so I started kite skiing probably 15 years ago, and had the dream of going to Greenland for a long time. It's kind of this dream destination for kiting. And for a long time, like didn't think it was going to happen. My kite skills weren't there. I didn't have the time, didn't have the money. And then we sold Gaia GPS, and then all of a sudden, two of those things were not as much of a problem. Had a little bit more time, had a little bit more money. And I was kind of at the point, too, with kiting, where I was kiting maybe 5 days a year. I would say I had just enough skills to get myself hurt. And then all of a sudden, had some more time and decided to invest in taking some lessons in kiting. So I went up to Alaska and went to a week-long snow kite camp and got the skills, or started to get the skills that I needed to actually be able to make the kiting part of going to Greenland reasonable. And then after a week in Alaska, I was like, okay, like I actually want to make this happen, and started to do some more research. And the logistics were like the single hardest part. And I had looked into guided trips because I couldn't even figure out, like, how do you even do the logistics? And there had been one person offering guided trips, but they were exorbitantly expensive. And then on my way home from Alaska, I was like in the Anchorage airport reading about Greenland again, and found a new company out in Norway offering guided trips for like a quarter of the price I had seen before.
Wow.
And then some funny things were happening with the exchange rate between the US dollar and the Norwegian kroner that like made the trip even more affordable. And then, yeah, 2022, I went to Greenland and spent... We were up on the ice for 15 days and then a couple days of travel either side of that, getting onto and off the ice. So we did a south-north crossing of about the middle third of Greenland. The route was kind of dictated by where the logistics were cheap. The southern end and the northern end both start to involve helicopters, where if you do that middle third, it's a pickup truck at the start and a dog sled at the end.
No way.
So we did about 1,200 miles of travel with kites over 14 days.
What?
Whoa.
Wait. How fast are you going?
Cruising is about 12 to 15 miles an hour.
Okay.
Yeah, kiting kind of opens up all these possibilities in backcountry travel. Like the speeds and distances you can cover just get kind of nuts. Like I had a day in Alaska last spring. I did 27,000 feet of vertical kiting. And that was not even a long day. You know, I think I started kiting at 9 a.m. that day and was done at 3 or 4.
Holy shit.
The kites really kind of open up another world for what's possible with non-motorized travel.
And what's it like? I'm assuming you're carrying a sled to bring your food and sleeping bag and tent and stove and stuff like that.
Yeah, so Greenland, we had two sleds each. Nothing fancy either, just like kind of cheap plastic sleds. Two sleds each lashed side by side so they don't flip over. And then each had a spare sled. And started out with probably around 150, 170 pounds of stuff each.
Oh,
food, dude, and fuel for 4 weeks.
Wow.
Spare ski, spare kites.
Yeah.
Wait, lots of gear. Wait, like, wait, split between how many people?
Three people.
Okay, so fit like roughly 55 pounds of gear each?
No, no, like 150 pounds of gear each.
Dude, wait, like
We started with 25 liters of white gas.
Oh my God.
Dude. That's like half a sled of white gas.
Which basically gas equals life on an expedition.
Yeah. Yeah. Damn, okay, and so wait, are you like, then you're kiting and you're like attached to the kite, but then how are you attached? How are the sleds attached to you?
So the kite's attached to a harness, sled's attached to the harness, and you're kind of just in the middle driving. The kiting part in Greenland is not, I thought it was going to be difficult, and the kiting part was not the hard part. Once we got up onto the ice sheet, it was flat. It was not smooth. Tons of sastrugi, big wind texture in the snow. Like, I'm definitely a year closer to needing new knees after that trip.
Did it shake your fillet loose?
Yeah, I did crack a tooth on that trip.
Whoa.
No way.
But the actual like travel with the kites was pretty straightforward. You know, the sled's behind you. The wind is super steady in Greenland. It's kind of some of the steadiest wind in the world. So
really?
You get the kite up in the air and you hold your hand in one place holding the bar. And sometimes it's cruising for an hour, just listening to music on the headphones and kiting in a straight line. Like, we kited straight north for 900 miles.
Wow. That's really surprising to hear that the wind is like that, because we're in Iceland. Jeff and I were in Iceland this spring, and I swear to God, the wind would be crazy every direction, every other hour.
Oh yeah, it's nothing like the wind in Iceland. It's the ice sheet is so big that it's katabatic winds coming down off the ice sheet. So the high point of the ice sheet is a little over 10,000 feet, and it's that big for a huge area. And we were traveling at about 9,000 feet, high enough to avoid fracture zones, so there wasn't significant crevasse risk.
Wow.
But not as low as we could be, because it just gets colder and colder and the wind is less reliable as you get higher. But it's some of the steadiest wind in the world. Like, there were no gusts. There were no direction changes.
Really?
Some of the fastest changes in wind speed we saw were like maybe a mile or two, maybe 2 or 3 miles an hour building or dropping.
That, wow. That's incredible.
That sounds perfect.
Crazy. Yeah.
What time of year was this?
April.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So the permitting to go up on the ice sheet is like pretty strict. Like, they won't let you on the ice sheet before April 15th. So we got on the ice on the 19th, and like they really want to know that you know what you're doing, and you're required to have rescue insurance, and there is only one company that is authorized to sell rescue insurance for the Greenland ice sheet, and it was the single biggest expense for the trip was search and rescue insurance.
Totally makes sense.
Because we had on a map like the zones that were within a single helicopter flight from a heli base. And then a big zone in the middle that's like, if you screw up here, first they fly out and drop fuel drums, and then they fly back to base, and then they refuel, and then come back to the fuel drums and refuel, and like, all of a sudden, the rescue logistics there are just astronomically expensive.
Yeah.
So that was the single biggest expense of the trip, was just paying for that rescue insurance.
Damn. That's Jeff. Quick, ask some more risk questions. My mind is blown. I don't even know what else to ask in this scenario.
I just love hearing about stuff that I have no idea about and just couldn't even begin to imagine all the logistics and considerations involved. And I would have thought navigating through crevasses with a huge sled would be incredibly dangerous. And you're like, no, it's pretty smooth most of the way. It's just a big ice cap. And it's
Actually roped up.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, how would you rope up on kites? Oh my God.
while kiting, there's no roping up, but we started out with 2 days of walking up through a glacier to get onto the actual ice sheet proper.
Yeah.
The glacier was really interesting. I've not seen a glacier form like that before. It was almost like sand dunes.
Really?
And it was 2 days of walking sand dunes, but bare blue ice. It was 2 days of walking with crampons, pulling sleds.
Did you shovel your loads?
Occasionally we'd actually have to like go one sled at a time. Most of the time it was pull the sleds 100 yards, unhook, walk and find the route for the next 100 yards, and repeat. We covered 10 miles in 2 days.
Oh.
Were you mentally prepared for what the first couple days were going to be like?
I was pretty worried at the end of those first 2 days. I was like, this is really hard. I don't know that I can do this. It was some of the hardest physical stuff in the outdoors I've ever done. Like, you know, pulling, because our weight loads were not optimized for that. Like, we went heavy, optimized for the rest of the trip.
Yeah.
Knowing that, like, we're going to suffer we had 5 days in the schedule for getting through that ice. And luckily we got through it in two, but it was brutal. And it was so hot too, even though temperatures were well below freezing, just being on bare ice, the UV was so intense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet.
And you're pulling massive loads. So you must have been burning 6,000-7,000 calories a day.
Oh yeah.
Did you get super skinny on this trip?
I lost a little bit of weight, not too much though. I both of the other guys I was with probably had 40 or 50 pounds on me. And I probably ate almost twice as much food as they did every day. They were both Norwegians and they were just laughing a lot of the time at how much food I would eat.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Were these guys guides or homies? Like
one Norwegian guide and one other client on the trip.
Okay. So when you were going, you said when you're just talking about the helis, when you started, were you the closest to kind of civilization and then you got getting further and further away as you went or how did that work?
Yeah. So starting out was like a 30-mile ride in a pickup truck to the edge of the ice and skiing up from there. And then after a couple days, kind of out of that helicopter zone for 500 or 600 miles. And then eventually towards the end, you get back towards another town.
Wow.
Damn.
This is your description of pulling sleds is giving me PTSD flashbacks of skiing Denali and towing sleds up the glacier. Just being like, oh my God, I know technically we're moving. It just doesn't feel like it.
So one of the interesting risk management things with the kiting up there is the travel speed is so fast.
Yeah.
That, you know, we're cruising at 15 miles an hour, sometimes faster than that.
Wow.
So if someone stops for 5 minutes, they're a long ways away.
Yeah.
And they're a long ways away upwind. So getting back to them is going to take significantly longer than it took to cover that distance downwind.
Oh, shit. Wow. Wait, so do you guys have like radios in your ear or how are you talking to each other?
We did not have radios. It was, you know, visibility is real big. And then the kites also, our kites are out in Greenland are on 50 meter lines. Yeah. So you've got a balloon up in the air way above you. So you can see people from a long ways, unless it's foggy and then you can't. But, you know, you can easily see people from a couple miles away. So lots of hand signals to check in. And then everyone carrying an inReach. So that's kind of the plan B if something happens and don't know where people are is like everyone stops and you get out the inReach and figure out what's going on and come up with a plan to regroup.
Wow.
Wait, you just said something about if it's foggy. So, okay, I've only been on one massive glacier and it was very disorientating. I don't know. But so and you're going 15 miles an hour, are there days where it's flat light? Or are you just like, what's that like?
Yeah. So one of, I think it was our second day of kiting, we got up and it was full on pea soup fog, like flat ground, flat light, half a mile of visibility through the fog, fully disorienting conditions that I had actually thought we wouldn't kite in. Right. Like they're conditions that like in Montana or Alaska, I wouldn't even think of kiting in, because I would like, I skied off a couple cornices kiting.
Yeah.
I crashed my kite into the side of a mountain that I couldn't see. And I figured there was no way we could travel in it. And that was one of the biggest things our guide did, was like convince me that like, nope, we can travel in this terrain, in this, because the terrain is flat and smooth and there are no real objective hazards here.
But so it's, sorry. So it's really flat enough. It's not even like little bumpy. Like it's flat enough that you could just cruise at that speed in flat light.
Yeah. You know, it's sastrugi. Wow. So you're kind of always ready to hit bumps, but yeah, really flat. Like there is nothing to fall off of, but super mentally taxing in the flat light days, constantly like working to keep ground orientation, like focusing on my ski tips to know where the ground is and keep my head around what level is, because the kite also adds this additional element of force where you have force pulling you upwards that can get confusing, especially on the flat ground. It doesn't, but like, so I got caught in an avalanche kiting 2 years ago and small slide, but it was super confusing, partially because of the force of the kite. Because I was going uphill kiting and there was like this 2 seconds that it felt like a minute where I could not figure out what was going on. It was like, I should be going uphill. I feel like I'm almost not moving. What is going on here? Like the forces don't make sense. And then I look at the snow and see cracks everywhere. It was like, oh, okay. Like, Now I understand why these forces don't make sense. Like, I'm actually staying in place on moving debris or maybe even moving downhill, but my speed over the snow from the kite, like, yeah, the forces get confusing.
Dude, that's, wow. Did you ever get like vertigo?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's like, it's concentrating hard to avoid getting vertigo.
How do you do that? What do you concentrate on?
It's a lot of, you know, sometimes taking turns being in front. So you have someone's ski tracks to look at.
Sure.
Because having those ski tracks, that's a linear feature.
Yeah.
Will really help to avoid that. Like, you know, kiting in Montana.
Absolutely desperate to, if you've got 2 people ahead of you, it feels like you're on vacation on the glacier all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah. Though kiting is interesting. Sometimes in Greenland, we had times where everyone is moving the same speed and the same direction. And you look at other people and it seems like you're not moving because there's no change in angle. There's no visual change between yourself and the other people.
Well, that's
so tricky. But then you look at the snow and the snow is moving by at 15 miles an hour.
What?
All right. Here's a question I've got. I was listening to a really interesting podcast on Hidden Brain last night, Radiolab, and they were talking about psychedelics and the ways it rewires your brain. And they said there's this window of learning post psychedelic experience, and it varies with the compound. And sometimes that window for rewiring your brain is a couple days, and for other compounds, it's a couple weeks. So this sounds like this was a totally foreign experience, like being on another planet where like the laws of physics are being rewritten or how you perceive them. So did you find that your brain was different afterwards? Like when I have a really great trip in the mountains, there'll be like a vacation half-life where I can go back to that feeling and sensation and perception.
Wait, Jeff, which kind of trip? You're talking about psychedelics and...
just being in the mountains skiing like or climbing or hiking or something like that, where you think back to that beautiful place and the vacation washes over you and you can feel it and touch it and taste it. So I'm wondering, did this change the way you perceived the world or interacted with the natural world? And, you know, in what ways maybe this spilled over into your work or your relationships? I'm super curious because this just sounds like such a no one on the planet has had this experience or very, very.
Yeah, it was tons of time to think. The middle of the trip, the days kind of all just started to blend together because it was, I mean, almost just like a flow state for huge extended periods of time because the technical difficulty is not that hard. Like technical difficulty was well within my scope. But you do still have to, you know, you got to pay attention. Like it's like minus 20, minus 30, you know, the kind of conditions where you have to pay attention because you really could die.
Yeah.
But tons of time to think. And yeah, it was wild how much the days just sort of blended together and maybe more time to think than I've ever had.
Wow. Well, did not your to family mention, and friends perceive you as different when you got back to civilization?
No. It was funny, too, because it was a trip that we had all been dreaming about for so long. Like, you know, I think like working towards that trip for like a decade, and same with the other client on the trip. Like,
wow.
And even the guide, too. Like he had been working towards being able to do it for a long time, too. So just this elation at the end of like, oh my God, like we did this thing. Together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like this really worked and it worked. It really came together. Like we had 21 days or 24 days on our permit maybe. And we got it done with over a week to spare. And like over half our food was left at the end of the trip. Like things really, really came together.
Yeah.
Damn, your buddies needed to eat more. Like, well, in April, hold up, Jeff, just really quick, in April, how long are the nights there even?
We saw our last sunset on night 3 of the trip.
Wow.
Whoa.
So we were moving straight north, days getting longer and moving straight north. So beginning of the trip, it didn't really get dark. End of the trip, the sun is moving in circles around the sky.
Oh, wow.
No wonder the days all merged together.
Our last night of the trip, we were camped on the sea ice and had to have someone on polar bear watch. And I got off my polar bear watch at 3 a.m, but it was totally light out and the wind was up. So I got to go kite on the sea ice around frozen icebergs at 3 a.m.
Dude,
what?
That is awesome. Did you have a rifle with you?
We carried a .30-06 the entire trip, yeah.
Damn.
Wow. So how has this changed the way you do your work, having this experience?
It gave me a lot of time to think about what I wanted to work on. And honestly, like a ton of the ideas for what to build for Goat Maps came out of that trip. I also had a ton of ideas for like things to build for expedition travel that I would still love to build, but there's just not a market for. Like, there's just not enough people going on huge polar expeditions to ever make a living on make a living off those products.
Three people a year.
It really opened my eyes too to just like what we could do with these kites and the kind of travel that was possible.
Dude, that is so cool.
Hey, shifting gears just a little bit. So you obviously spend a lot of time thinking about how to do risky things the safest way possible. And you're not just on your first startup. You've done a bunch of startups. What intrigued you about Aspect Avi? And thank you very much for investing in Aspect Avi. And then thank you for doubling down on your investment. What was it intrigued you about Aspect Avi?
I think my big takeaway from the ARI 1 and 2 courses I took the last couple of years is that decision-making is still the hard part. And decision-making is not getting any easier. And all of the avalanche accidents that happen still seem to largely be about making decisions is hard. And there's tons of like great new snow science research and even lots of research on the human factors too, but like none of it really seems to be doing anything to make that decision-making part of things easier. And I liked your pitch about building something to help make people make decisions, giving people better tools for that.
Hell yeah.
Well, I'd like to extend an invitation. We've set our in-house Aspect Abbey team avalanche course, and it's 2 weeks self-directed online curriculum and then 2 days here in Crested Butte, if you can swing it, on December 16th and 17th in person. And then the 2 weeks self-directed, we'll have some Zoom calls, but it'll be a mixture of all the people who work on the app, on the dev team, as well as Trailhead ambassadors and one of our newest ambassadors that we're excited to announce, Molly Armenino. She was number two on the World Free Ride Tour last year. She reached out to us to partner on this project. And then, yeah, a bunch of our investors and advisors. So if you'd like to do the online part or make it to Crested Butte for the field sessions, it'll be totally different than anything you've seen before.
I might be able to make that. I'll have to see. I'm actually in a week and a half from now, I'm heading to Ecuador to go do some volcano skiing.
Sick.
What?
Dude, we got to have you on again to just talk about all these sweet adventures you're going on.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
That's sick. Jesse, where can people find you, man?
Instagram, Threads, Skier Crocker.
Cool.
And then Goat Maps is goatmaps.com and Goat Maps on the Apple App Store and Goat Maps on any social media platform, pretty much.
Awesome. We'll put those links in the description. Well,
If there's anyone out there that wants to try out Goat Maps, it's a subscription app, but we're doing a discount right now. Use the offer code LAUNCH when you go to try it out, and you can get I think a 30% discount. And we've got a great pro deal program too. Like if you are a working ski guide or working ski patroller, send me an email, jesse@goatmaps.com, and our pro deal, at least for the first year, is free. So hit me up.
I got to say, Jesse, I really appreciate the double meaning for Goat Maps.
Yeah.
I like the idea of the mountain goat. Like I love Ibex or Steinbach or Bucatan in Europe, you know, with the giant horns and just how adept they are at traveling through the mountains. But I love that you're like, I've been working on this for, I mean, well over a decade in this space. And you're like, we're going to make the greatest of all time. That's pretty fun.
Yep.
Nailed it. Well, Jesse, thanks so much for coming on. It was awesome talking to you, man. You got some great stories and cool insights, and I would definitely like to talk to you again sometime soon. So if you're available, maybe you can come back.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Cool.
All right. Cheers, Jesse. Thanks so much.
Cheers, guys. That's it. That's the show. Thanks so much for listening, watching, however you're doing your pods these days. If you like what we're doing, please consider subscribing. Leaving a review or a rating, sending it to your friends, really does help us out. One last thanks to our business daddy, Aspect Abbey, for making the All Aspects podcast possible. If you want to try out Aspect Abbey for yourself, head on over to the App Store and download it on iOS for free. Thanks so much for listening, watching, and we'll see you in the next one. You.